You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
My name is Kyle Clifton. I'm from, grew up in the village of Hartley Bay. It's about 80 miles south of Prince Rupert. The proposed Enbridge pipeline ends in Kitimat, and you can't get from Kitimat to the ocean without going right through the far side of that picture right there. So we would see the tankers go by there. Small community. There's only 160 to 180 people that live in Hartley Bay. It's quite isolated. It's, like I said, 80 miles from Prince Rupert and 50 miles from Kitimat. There's no roads in or out of there. The whole village is, the houses are connected by boardwalk. So you walk on boardwalk wherever you go. And you have to take either a seaplane or a ferry to get to the community when you want to come to Hartley Bay. Gitgat is the name of our people. The Gitgat is a Tsimshian place name that means, when translated, means people of the cane. The name comes from the site of our original village that was too shallow to paddle our canoes, so people pushed the canoe around with a pole. So people of the cane. Is the name that we got. Our dependence on natural resources gives us a different perspective on resource management. These resources aren't just about money. They're about food and protecting our way of life. We're not interested in industry that risks what we have. There's no amount of money that would make us support this Enbridge pipeline project. We've got a lot of issues facing us. We've got commercial fishing. We used to employ the whole village, and now just a small portion of the community is in commercial fishing. There's also tourism and recreation, which is our major employer now, but it still has some issues that we need to resolve. It's environmental risks that were brought to the forefront by the Queen of the North spill, and increasing activity only increases the risks. There's also port activity by our neighbors in Prince Rupert and Kitimat. All of them want to increase shipping, for whether it's containers or oil, condensate, natural gas. Everyone seems to be wanting to ship something through the north coast of BC. The sinking of the Queen of the North in March 2006 really opened our eyes to the risks of shipping. The fuel that leaked from this vessel damaged not only the environment, but also, more importantly, it affected our perception of what is healthy. It took pretty much 2 years before people were really comfortable going out and harvesting our foods again. When the Queen of the North sank, that was pretty much the end of our shellfish season, and we don't normally start that until the fall again. But when fall came around, people were really afraid to go out because you don't know if the beach has been contaminated. That's one major difference from the slides that you've seen from the other presenters, is that this bill was diesel and theirs was crude oil. Crude oil, you see black or red or all these things that are easy to see, but diesel, you wouldn't even see it on the beach. You would smell it, see the sheen on the water, but you wouldn't know for sure if the shellfish that you're eating was contaminated. In terms of the response to the sinking, the people from our village that went out to help in the rescue, we're on the scene 40 minutes after the incident at 1 o'clock in the morning in March, which is not a good time at all to be out on the boat. And the Coast Guard was there 90 minutes after the incident, and they were that was just probably by fluke that they had one of their big ships in the area, because it's not every day that Coast Guard has a presence on that part of the coast. After the incident, some of the survivors came into Hartley Bay, and they picked up the rest of them, then came into Hartley Bay and picked up all of them, had them all on the boat and headed to Prince Rupert. And then basically left our guys on the scene until Burrard Clean got there, which is the company that has the contract to do the cleanup, 18 hours later. So our guys were out there cleaning up debris, and they're reaching into the water, picking up things that are soaked in diesel, not realizing that that's probably not a very smart thing to do. But they were there, and they cleaning up the best they could until Burrard Clean got there. And in terms of cleanup, there actually was no cleanup other than collection of debris. They attempted to collect oil by using skimmers and things like that, but they worked, I don't know how long they worked with the skimmers, but they only ended up recovering with something dumb like 18 liters out of 200,000. The focus on the response was mainly on booming beaches and letting Mother Nature take care of it. So you basically use the boom, which these guys told you already are next to useless, to block off a beach. And then hoping, basically getting this big body of oil to just move off and let someone else look after it. The boat is still there and still leaking fuel into Wright Sound. And we do testing, but can't really make sure that our food sources aren't still being contaminated. Like the testing is fairly expensive, and it takes a long time. We did testing in September, and we just got results maybe a week ago. And they haven't even been analyzed yet to tell us if they're safe or not. We've got the numbers, but we still haven't even got them. So our harvest season is coming to an end, and we still wouldn't be able to tell one way or the other whether they're safe to eat or not. We're already a bit nervous about eating some of these things because we know that they've been polluted and never know for sure if it's safe to eat or not. We've been told that it's safe to eat, but these people will tell you it's safe to eat, and then they'll also tell you that there's PAHs in smoked fish, and if you eat barbecued food, there's chemicals in there too that'll hurt you, and you just have to pick your poison, which is one of their favorite things to say. So I try and tell them that, okay, we're going to quit eating food and start drinking diesel. Our spill is tiny compared to what these guys had to deal with, but it showed that we are by no means ready to deal with a major spill. We did things like booming our major harvest beaches, but not thinking that some of the smaller beaches could be because clams and other shellfish are, they call it broadcast spawning, where they just spit out eggs and sperm, and that they meet up in the water column and then drift to the next beach, and then they'll settle in a beach somewhere. So we blocked off our major harvest beaches, but we didn't block off the beaches that could be providing seed for those. And another thing was that the places they assessed the background levels were areas that could have been contaminated by other means. So the areas they used to compare the results could have been, they were closer to industrial areas that could have already been polluted a little bit. Instead, our people wanted them to go further in some of the outside islands where it has less traffic to test it out to make sure that it's okay. But they knew better than us, I guess. So that is another thing. We would have liked to have background levels that could actually be proven to be clean. Another thing that we learned is that about background studies. We have no background studies that are completed in our territory. A background study would tell you how the stock is doing, how much you have there, and that kind of stuff. We go out on the beaches and we see smaller clams, and we see clams that are dead when you're digging. Like, I'd never seen so many dead clams as the first time I went out there. I'm digging away, and then you pick up the clam, and then this slime just falls out of the shell. That was really stink. And we kept digging. We ate those clams. Probably wasn't the smartest thing to do either, but that's our food. So without the background studies, we can't compare stocks from what they were before the spill and what they were after. And no hard numbers means no compensation, and more importantly probably to us, is no levels that people should be enforced to restore the stock to. So without these background studies being completed, there's no way you end up being in the same situation as the people in the Exxon Valdez spill, where they are still, over 20 years later, still fighting in court, but they can't prove what they've lost because there's no background information. Another thing that we learned is that response should always focus on cleanup and protection of places rather than just deflection. There shouldn't be any of that let Mother Nature take her course. Mother Nature may have created oil, but she didn't really create an efficient way of cleaning it up. Tides and currents and winds just spread it around. They don't get rid of it. It just makes it go somewhere else. Yeah, it should never be just sent away to be someone else's problem. That should never be a solution to a spill. If it can't be completely cleaned up, then we shouldn't risk making the mess in the first place. And a last example is, everybody's heard of the Exxon Valdez. This is a map that was completed to show how far the oil spread from Valdez. But if you take that outline and put it over the coast of British Columbia, you see how big that spill is. Basically goes from well into southeast Alaska all the way down to mid-Vancouver Island. And that was the Exxon spill, in terms of some of the other spills that have happened in the world, has been, in terms of numbers, it's actually one of the smaller spills. But in terms of cost, because of the habitat and species and things that it destroyed, ended up being one of the most expensive. And thank you. Thank you very much to Forest Ethics and to my co-presenters. I learned a lot from you guys today, and I really appreciate it.